Well, with the relationship to my parents, I remember feeling very alone often because my father traveled a lot. He was always away. He worked in the oil industry. So he'd be gone for months at a time. And being one of four children, there's only so much emotional capacity a mum can give all these children. And my sisters were twins, so it's like that's a lot. So I always felt quite alone as a child. And I remember always feeling like I was searching for something. It was actually a torment. And I searched for it in my, I remember feeling it. And so I'd look for it in my mum and I'd look for it in my dad. Like, oh, when mum is with me, maybe I'll feel better. If dad was with me, I'd feel better. So that was definitely projected onto my parents as well. So it was like this constant feeling of something's wrong, I'm missing something. And then that was extended to dad's not here, mum's not emotionally here. So that it was pretty empty, actually, if I'm honest.
That's sad and it's unfortunate. I don't know the circumstances around why your dad wasn't there. And fathers sometimes have good reasons, sometimes have bad reasons, but the result is always negative. So that's an unfortunate thing that happened. How was school for you?
School was an extension of that same feeling. School was, I never felt like I belonged, never felt like I fit in. And no matter what I did, like trying to follow the trends or get the haircut that everyone's got or get the school bag everyone's got, it always seemed to be a lonely experience. And I moved schools quite a lot because of my dad moving around. So I probably went to about four or five schools and I was bullied in every single school. There seemed to be like a plant of someone. Every school I went to, there was just someone that seemed to want to attack. And with that attack, they would always bring a clan of people with them. So each primary school I went to, I was quite isolated. And then when I went to got to high school, the bullying was really bad. The first year was safe, but then by the second year, it was people stabbing me with pens, people chasing me around the school, people yelling profanity at me and calling me names and chasing me, and just it was so horrible. And I just remember feeling humiliated. I was so embarrassed that no one liked me. It's like, why do people like me? And I tried so hard to make people like me, but I couldn't figure it out. And so it was just lonely. It was lonely. And I would lunchtimes, whenever the bell rang for lunchtime, it was like this dread that came over me because I knew that I didn't have anywhere to go. And everyone would get together, like, oh, let's go eat here, let's go eat there, let's go. And I didn't have anyone. And it was so embarrassing because I'd have to go and find places to hide so that people didn't know that I didn't have any friends. So I would go and eat my lunch in the restrooms in different blocks because you can't stay in one place for a whole hour and 15 minutes. So I was like, right, go to the maths block, have my sandwich there, science block, have my other half of my sandwich, you know. And I just did that for the whole hour and a half or hour and 15 minutes. And it was horrible. It was lonely. And it created more isolation and it created more emptiness. And it seemed like there was never a break. So at home, I felt lonely. And then at school, I was made to be lonely. And it seemed to me that that was my whole existence.
That's what I was going to say. Like having that at school is already hard. Having that at home is already hard. Now you bring the two together, it's very difficult because you never have like refuge. You never have this sense of belonging or being, I don't know if being safe is like the right word because, but maybe anyway, how do you think that impacted you long term? Like the bullying when it comes to, because you talked about the teenage years, like did it change who you were?
It definitely put me into survival. Like I only knew myself as someone surviving. And it made me a good survivor. It meant that I could stand in the face of things that some people couldn't stand in the face of. But it left me with this feeling of no one likes you. And that becomes a voice all the time. And then you take everything personally. If something is off or someone's having a bad day because of their own life and they're off, you think, what have I done? What's so bad about me? Why don't you like me? So it made me walk around all the time with this feeling of like, no one loves you, no one likes you, you might as well not even be here. No one would care if you weren't here. It let those voices manifest.
Yeah. Did you have any kind of spiritual teaching or education at the home? What did your parents believe in? Was there anything like that going on?
I would say my mother especially, but probably both my parents, I'd say they have religious wounds. So my mom's probably quite anti-religion. And although we didn't have these conversations often, we knew this. She had her best friend was raised as a Jehovah's Witness. And my mom saw her go through a lot of pain during that time when she tried to come out of the religion. And so she had this real bitter taste of religion. So religion wasn't something that was brought into the home. I was christened as a baby, but that was just because that's what you did. It wasn't because of anything else. So there was nothing. There was no talk of it. I was given a Bible as a baby when I got christened. It's like a children's Bible. And I do remember going and actually picking it up quite often. It was in our, like, we had this sort of office study library thing in our house. All the books were there. And this one always stood out. It was like, oh, and I pick it up and like go through the pages. And I'm like, something really special is in here. Oh, but I don't understand. I was like, nothing made me want to read it, but I knew. I was like, this is really important.
I've watched another interview of yours and you were talking about your house being haunted. And I haven't heard really much details about that. What did you mean when you said that in the other interview, and what kinds of things were you referring to?
So the house that I grew up in, we moved there when I was 6 years old, and I lived there till I was about 20. It was a long time. And there was an encounter that my mum had when she was feeding my sisters one day in one of the rooms there, where this coldness went through her body and it kind of out the other side, and it terrified her. And so I would have been about 7 years old. So I wasn't there for that, but she told me about it. And she rang a psychic and said to ask what that was, because it actually haunted her. And this woman said, oh, it's nothing to worry about. It's children. It's ghosts, but it's just children and they're just playing. So what that then did, because that sounds like it's not a threat, is that she kind of accepted these things in the house. It was an acceptance. It was like, oh, I don't have four kids. I have eight, because four are here with me and there's all other ones running around all the time. So I grew up with that being common knowledge, like part of the family, the ghosts. And one of my babysitters, I remember my mum telling me, she said she kept hearing like kids running up and down the landing upstairs. And she thought my sisters were out of bed and misbehaving. So she went upstairs. They were completely asleep. And so she came back downstairs and then she heard it again. She's like, what is going on? And when she told my mum's like, oh, it's just the ghost. It's the children ghosts. Don't worry about it. They're always running around. It's fine. Like, it's totally fine. It's okay. And so what that did for me was like, oh, it is okay. Except I can't sleep at night because these things keep interfering with me. And from what I'm aware of, none of my siblings have this problem. It was just me. So when I was trying to sleep, they would pull my bed covers. They would jump on my bed. They would poke my face. I could feel them here. I could literally feel them trying to scare me and intimidate me. And they were literally up here in my face. I could see this like dark shadow, feel it. And I would know where they were in my room. They would walk. It was an old house. So where you can hear where everyone is because the floors creak. Okay. It's like this house is old. So they would walk around my bed and I'd feel them. They come in through the door, across the end of the bed, and then here. And then everything would go silent. And I'm like, they're right there. They're standing right there. Nothing's happening. And I would not move for a good few minutes. And then I'd hit the floorboards, go again, like this. And then I had a wicker chair in the corner of my room. And I'd hear it creak. And then go silent. And I would literally just lay there like, oh gosh, now they're on the chair. And they're just watching me. You can imagine I didn't get much sleep. Biggest torment. It was horrible and it was suspenseful. Because being like poked and pulled at is one thing, but to know that they're there and they're watching, that's worse.
What happened? So I have a few questions, but what happened to the babysitter? Did she ever come back?
She did come back. She adapted. She was like, she'd hear the landing, be like, oh, it's the ghost. It's fine. She completely adapted to it, and everyone did. And everyone knew our house to be that in the end. And my father, he had the house extended when I was about 10 or 11. And so you kind of knew where the new parts of the house were in a way, because they wouldn't sometimes cross that threshold. But in the living room, there was a presence. And that living room was never extended. It was always the old part of the house. And so I wouldn't go and sit in my own living room and watch TV, because something was always in that corner. And we always knew it. And my brother would say the same thing. He's like, yeah, but you're not going to go in the living room, are you? What, on your own? All right, go on then. Enjoy. Like, this was standard. This was normal.
So all of you could hear the floor crack?
My mom and dad could hear the landing, them running up and down the landing. No one ever said anything to me about hearing them at night. My siblings have never mentioned it. There were a few incidences where my sisters were like playing with those like cashier, those little pretend cashier things where you give money and the button started going down on their own. And they ran out of the room into my room for help. So there were things like that. I would see light switches go on and off. But again, it was like, well, it's just the ghost. What do you want me to do about it? So we did get a vicar. We had a vicar come in and you know, pray over the house, but it just actually made it worse.
Wow. Okay. I didn't expect that. That threw a curveball. But I think it's going to make sense of some of the experiences that you had later on, or at least it's going to connect to it in some way. Not that I know exactly how they connect, but it's very interesting. Before we move on from this, you said that the house was extended, and the way that you talked about it, it seemed like the ghosts never went to the new part of the house, almost like they weren't allowed there. Is that right? Or is it just because the floors were new and you wouldn't hear them?
I think they didn't cross that threshold of where the extension was, because it was just in the kitchen. So we extended the kitchen, and then it was the upstairs. My brother's room was new. And my sister's room was half new. So when they were playing with their cashier thing, they were sat in their bedroom, but on the old side of the bedroom. So it used to be a hallway, and then they extended it and made it into a bedroom. So they were sat on where it was the old hallway. So they didn't really get the torment. And my brother didn't, not in his room, but his room was new. Mine was old, and my mum's and dad's bedroom was old. So I don't know. I don't quite know how that, because in, I don't think demons really have a problem crossing any barriers, really. But I just noticed that there wasn't as much there. But there was always something at the bottom of the stairs. My brother would come home from like a late shift, and I'd always hear him run up the stairs as fast as he could. Every time he would belt up those stairs three at a time. Like, he would get upset because he'd always say, there's something at the bottom of the stairs that's chasing me up. And I would feel that too. So him and I would always laugh about that. Like, well, you better get up the stairs quick then. Because we always knew there was something there.
It's almost like they had a right to the old house. And when you built, they didn't. So they like couldn't cross. It almost sounds like that to me. It's very, very interesting, but it's like horrible that this happened to you. So I'm very sorry that you had to deal with that, because, you know, it's one thing to talk about and be like, oh, ghosts, but like, it's another thing when they're there at night watching you.
Yeah.
It's very, the fun completely goes out of it. Like, there's nothing fun about that. Yeah. Like, it's horrible. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Well, I'm happy that we got to touch on that, because I didn't know, and it's actually pretty fascinating. But let's go back to your teenage years. We talked about high school, the fact that you were bullied, but how did your personality shift when you got a little bit older?
I think I started to rebel a little bit, because it was this feeling of, I'm so sick and tired of trying to fit in and it doesn't work. I try and be myself and no one likes me. So I think I put on this mask, this sort of persona of I'm just going to make myself ugly and make myself different so that, first of all, maybe feel powerful, but it also was like, well, bully the facade then instead of who I really am, because I'm quite a soft, sensitive person. And it was really tough. So I think I got to about the age of 14, 15, and I started to really change. Some of it might have just been hormonal, but some of it was just like, I've had enough. And I started to change how I looked and what I was doing. I went to a friend's house and I dyed my hair jet black, like jet black. And my parents were horrified, but I did that. And I started wearing dark makeup, dark lipstick, started getting piercings, started to wear black clothes, wanted to put studs and chains on everything that I wore. And I just carried this darkness. And I think I was probably about 15 or 16, I started self-harming and really going down that route. I mean, I've still got the scars today, actually, which is my mark of the past. But that was something that I think I genuinely can say, honestly, I wanted attention. I felt so invisible. I was like, can someone see me, please? Can someone pay attention? Because it really didn't feel like anyone was paying attention. So it was my cry for help, which backfired, because it didn't bring me any extra help. It just made me become more introverted. And I think my final cry for help at that age was I developed an eating disorder, and I just didn't eat for like 2 years, just starved myself until I became really thin. So you can imagine I've gone from like this blonde, fluffy, happy, girly girl, love the Spice Girls, singing in my room, whatever, to this thin, frail, bony, bleeding, black-haired thing that people didn't quite recognize. But I mean, all doors were open. All doors were open, and I didn't sleep properly. So I'm always tired and I don't fit in and I can't fit in. And the school system to me never made sense. So I just wanted to paint. I wanted to draw. I wanted to paint. I wanted to write and I wanted to make clothes. I wanted to dress and look cute. And that was it. That was my whole persona, like fashion, painting, beautiful things, art. That was my life. And the school system, it's so eager to get that out of you, to make you fit into their system. And it was really just another way for me to feel like I don't belong in this world. Those thoughts of like, well, I can't do it. And I, you know, everyone else was passing their exams and everyone seemed to find life so easy. And I'm like, oh, sweetheart, life's hard. And school's hard. And I failed all my exams, but all of them, apart from art. Everything else is just a hard fail. Because I didn't do it and I didn't care and I didn't find it interesting and I had other problems. So half of me, I can say I was quite self-absorbed, but really I was just starving for attention, starving to be seen. And that voice of like, but no one likes you. Like everyone hates you. So why are you even here? And that manifest is like, well, you know, maybe you can be a goth and then the goth kids will like you. You know, maybe if you cut yourself, this was the voice, right? Maybe if you cut yourself, your mom will see that you're bleeding and she'll love you. Maybe if you starve yourself to the point where you're so thin, your dad will come home. So it puts a lot of pressure on one person to manipulate everything around her. That's what was happening.
I think we see a lot of that, and different generations have different whatever groups, but if you look back through the different generations, you'll see that the kids that don't fit in usually, they try to make themselves fit into a different box so that at least they accept them. And so like today it's one thing, 20 years ago it was a different thing, 20 years before it was a different thing, but you see that pattern a lot. So did you eventually come out of that? Was it a phase essentially? Did you come out of it?
I came out of it when I passed my driving test at 17 because it gave me some freedom. Like I always felt too small for my town, too small for my home, too small for the world, to be honest. So when I passed my driving test, I was like, oh, you know, I can just go shopping. I can just go and look at art galleries. I can just go and sit somewhere and paint. So it gave me some freedom there. And so I came out of it. And when I'm done with something, I'm done. I'm not the kind of person that's like, oh, I'm slowly going to, you know, start to. No, I was like, woke up one morning. I was like, I'm completely done with this. And I said to my father, I was like, Dad, I'm going to get the black taken out of my hair. He was like, here's my credit card. Go now. And I said to him, like, 2 weeks later, that took 5 hours, by the way. It was a long process. 2 weeks later, I was like, I want to get clothes. Like, I want the pink back, or I want the color. And again, my dad was like, here's the credit card. Go and get what you need. So I sort of took out all the black clothes and put in all the colorful clothes and found myself again, because fashion was always something I was interested in. So suddenly I was like, oh, I can get back into my fashion and start to get back into my, you know, the art that I wanted to do, because school was over. So I didn't have to keep thinking about math, science, biology, stuff that I didn't care about. I could actually focus on art. And for when I got to college, I did art and photography as my diplomas. So it meant that I could finally like find a bit of myself again. So that probably pulled me out.
Okay. Well, that's good that you came out of that. And obviously, you know, we could see this today, but yeah, it's good that it didn't last too long, because that was very destructive to you. So I'm happy about that. But a lot of your adult years, I would say, were characterized by New Age stuff. And so I wanted to ask you, how and when were you introduced to the New Age?
I had read, when I was 19, I had read Abraham Hicks' Ask and It's Given. And when I first started to read it, I couldn't really make sense of it. But it was like a sliver of something which opened my eyes to this world of manifestation and creating your reality and magic, basically. But when I was 25, I read The Secret, and that probably opened the door, because what The Secret is, it's a very simplified version of the law of attraction. It's very materialistic. It's, you can have the nice car and you can have the boyfriend and then you can have the money, and it's all very surfacey. But she's made it very simple for people to read. And so it's a really easy door to open.
So why did that? Because I know that's a book that's very, very popular. A lot of people that I talk to are like, I got into these things because of The Secret. Why did it resonate with you so much?
It resonated with me because I knew I was missing something. You know, I said at the beginning, like, there's something missing in my life. And it's an imitation of the truth. And so when I read it, I was like, this is what I've been missing. There is a whole world out there, and I can create my own reality, and I can do all these things. And there was a part of me that always felt so powerless, because, like I said, I felt too small for my town. I felt too small for my own life. And I wanted to design clothes, and I wanted to paint and write books, and I wanted to be out there in the world. And I knew there was something I was supposed to do. So your whole life, you're like, there's something I need to do, but you don't know what it is. That's its own torment. It's so frustrating. So when I read it, I was like, oh, maybe this is what I've been missing. I can create my own reality. So actually, if I just visualize my clothing line and my artwork and my books, then it's going to happen, right? And I'd always wanted to go. I had a strong call to get to New York from when I was really young, for no reason. I just always wanted to get there. And so I'd start visualizing to try and get to all these places. I want to take my clothing line to New York, and which I did. And I thought I manifested it, but I didn't. It was really hard work. That was just me slugging along, doing the work that needed to be done, like any other person in the world. But what it did was it broke the life that I had. And I actually had a really good life. I had a great boyfriend at the time. He was fantastic. I have nothing bad to say about him. He's a friend today. And we got on great. We never had problems in our relationship until I read that book. I had to go back and apologize to him many years later and say, I'm so sorry. Because he always claimed, as soon as you read that book, you changed. Like, I lost my woman when you read that book. So it let something in because I didn't feel the same. And it also brought pride because I remember thinking, oh, I know this secret. So that means that I know something that other people don't know. So I'm better than everyone.
Is that what he would tell you? Did he explain like how you changed?
No, he could never put his, he never put his finger on it. He just, I remember he said to me, like, you just changed. Like something in you, you weren't with me anymore is what he'd say. You weren't quite with me anymore. Which, to be fair, I wasn't, because I wanted a different type of life than what he really wanted. And once I read that book, I thought, I can go and get that life. But he didn't want that life. And so rather than us just being doing our thing and building our life together, which we were doing, suddenly it was like, oh, I can go over here and do this though. So I think I detached from him.
Okay. So that was like the gateway to witchcraft. Like witchcraft, I forget who said that. I think it's a like famous occultist, but essentially saying that witchcraft is putting will into reality, something like that, which is what manifestation is. It's just you don't have rituals. But you did become known for tarot readings, which is more traditional witchcraft. How did you get introduced to tarot?